is Eddie, and I was in a call.
Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to survive or evacuate is to leave with us.
Started as an effort by a charismatic preacher to build a new society, but it ended, of course, with the tragic deaths of more than 900 people.
Please, for God's sake, let's get on with it. We've lived as no other people have lived and loved. We've had as much of this world as you're going to get. Let's just be done with it. Let's be done with the agony of it. This is a revolutionary suicide. This is not a self-destructive suicide. So they're paying for this. They brought this upon us.
I love you, and I want you out of it and with Christ. But you're...
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Cultish, Entering the Kingdom of the Cults. My name is Jeremiah Roberts. I'm one of the co-hosts here, and I am excited today. This is going to be Volume 3 of Leaving the Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you guys have watched our previous episodes or have listened to them, Volume 1, I had Clay Fry, and you are with me here once again. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Awesome, man. Awesome. I'm really excited. And we've had a great last two episodes, both with yourself and with Nathan talking about his experience. We went into also some of the theology behind the Watchtower and how to have a good and gracious discussion with someone on the street. And so we have with us today someone who connected with us, and just from talking with her a little bit, we definitely knew we wanted to have her on because this is the third volume, but I think it's important to get a woman's perspective of what it is like to grow up in the Watchtower. She has a unique story, very unique testimony. So I want to go ahead and welcome to the very first time Jackie Primo to Cultish, and you've got quite the story. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So let's just jump into it. Just talk about what it was like growing up on the Watchtower, and just go back to your first memories or what it was like just growing up as a child, and just tell us what you recollect from the very beginning, and let's go from there.
Yeah, so I was a third generation Jehovah's Witness. My dad's dad started going to meetings and studying when my dad was about 5 years old. So up to that point, you know, my grandpa was a smoker and in the war as a nurse, and my dad was having Christmases. So it was a big adjustment for him at the age of five. My mother became a Jehovah's Witness when she was a teenager, around 13, with a couple of her sisters. But her parents and two of her siblings were never part of the religion. So I was born into it and was going to the doors at a young age, and you know, going and studying. I remember practicing and rehearsing for going door to door the next day. So Friday night, we're, you know, running our skits and just pretending that we're going to the door, and it was made fun. And then, you know, service on Saturdays, meetings on Sunday. I would try to raise my hand at least twice and answer twice. That was always my goal, because then I was legit, you know. And then Tuesday nights, growing up, we had the book study down in our basement. We lived in basement, nothing creepy. And then on Thursdays, we went to the Kingdom Hall for the meetings. And I would have parts on the stage where you also run your practice and show an example of what it would be like to go to the door. And if there's, you know, like a problem that comes up, if they're trying to turn you down, and how you would handle that. So it was just really busy.
Wow. Yeah, and it just that's interesting too, because that's it definitely is a line of familiarity there, just like going to, you know, all the different meetings and staying incredibly busy. So that seems to be very much like normative experience from my perspective, and that obviously, Clay, you would say that as well too, going to all those meetings too.
Yeah, the theocratic ministry school, I think, is what you were talking about, and we would definitely like get a lot of training on answering objections that were specific to the Jehovah's Witness, you know, type of reasoning, you know, that we would have to go out and talk to people, because our theology and reason and what we believed was a lot different than everybody else. So we would always try to prepare to have something to say.
Yeah. And it seems like it sounds like you're saying that, especially even as a young child, like you really kind of wanted the approval and acceptance of other people. That's why you're raising your hand twice.
Yeah. 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 If you didn't have your watchtower underlined, people would make comments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, what were you so busy doing that you didn't have time for Jehovah?
Exactly.
Know? Like, you didn't get your highlighter out for this.
Sometimes I would just get my highlighter and just mark it up so nobody would say anything to me.
Yep. Definitely can relate to that.
Yep.
Yeah. So did you end up going to, because when we were talking in our last episode, talking with Nathan, he was talking about kind of like the first time he kind of realized that you get on some level at some point, usually you're going to be exposed to like life outside the group, or if like you're going to school. And then there's those moments where you're like, wait a second, other people celebrate birthdays, but then I don't. What was like a point like growing up where you had a moment of like realization of, okay, this is a little bit different from like the normative on some level experience, like growing up as a child.
Yeah. I feel like we were kind of prepared a little bit before going into school. My mom had daycare in our house growing up. But we still went to public schooling, and going in, I mean, I think it's kind of an advantage being so little starting out at school, because, you know, you don't have the full knowledge that you do as you get older. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I remember that it was in elementary school. I think it was second grade, and there was a birthday party, but it was, you know, they weren't like super fancy. It wasn't totally known what was going on. All I knew was that they were making dirt and worms, and I was ready for it. I was like, nothing is going to stop me from eating this. This is my favorite. And so I ate that, and then I realized, oh shoot, this is a birthday party. And got home, told my parents, and they were loving about it, but they were like, you can't be doing that. You know, we don't celebrate birthdays and all that. But what was confusing for me was, there was a time later on in like middle school where I knew someone had a birthday like the day before, and they were bringing home the popsicles the next day. And it was totally fine that I could have the popsicles now, because it wasn't the celebration day.
Yep.
So it was really confusing. I was like, where is the line drawn, and how do I follow this?
Yeah. Or like even Halloween candy, how, you know, it was all on sale after Halloween. So we would buy bags of Halloween candy after Halloween and eat it. And it was okay then, but not before. It was confusing as a kid. Yeah.
Yeah. And are there even times where, like, cause you guys didn't, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't celebrate the 4th of July. Like, are there times though, like as a kid, you're seeing like the fireworks off in the distance and you're like, oh, like, I know I'm not supposed to celebrate that, but it looks so cool. Like, is that like a mindset you'd have as well too?
Yeah. So my dad actually worked in a grocery store my whole life. And so he would bring home loads and loads of like the discounted candy after the holidays. So I can totally relate to that. And I was like, I don't care what the rule is right now, because I'm still getting all of the candy. You know, I didn't have to dress up and go to the doors again. I got to just get the candy.
Yeah.
So one last time, you know, didn't have to go to the doors for something. But yeah, so yeah, it's just so confusing. So confusing.
A lot of rules.
Yep. Yep. So what would you say, and I'm genuinely curious about this too, and we can also flush this out. When it comes to, we've had a lot of interactions with Mormons, for example, there's a lot of times, especially growing up, at least what I've heard and what I've had conversations with people about. In fact, there's a great, we had a relationship with this lady named Judy Robinson. She wrote a book called Out of Mormonism. And she had talked about her experience for a while being in the Mormon church and coming out of it. But one of her big moments was that she had someone that she looked up to, and who was the bishop's wife. And she seemed to have it all together. She's got all the kids, and they're, you know, there's the white picket fence. And, you know, she's part of like all the different Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you know, doing all those things to contribute, being the perfect Mormon wife. And she really looked up to this lady, and this bishop's wife pulled Judy aside and said, like, I don't know how much more I can do this. I'm like burning the candle at both ends. And that was really eye-opening for her. Like, there was just this subtle pressure on that. And you can flesh this out, but would that be something like that? Would that be normative for like a woman growing up on the Watchtower?
Yeah. So I saw it mostly in my mom. Mm. My mom is like the picture perfect Jehovah's Witness woman. you know, someone dies in the Kingdom Hall and she is the one running the funeral and the meals, and she's on top of all of it. She's making the phone calls. Mm-hmm. If a part is like somebody has to cancel because they're sick, and my mom's the one to cover it. You know, my mom has health problems, but she always pushes through and does whatever she needs to do, you know, to be dependable. Mm. So, yeah, you know, she works full time and she was definitely exhausted. She would always, one of her sayings was, "I've got a million things to do." So she was very stressed out at home, but, you know, put on that smile and did what had to be done. And I know it's always been in her heart, and she loves to help others. But yeah, you could see that she was tired. And there was just a different, I don't know. She was authentically herself, but you put on your best, you know?
There's not as many choices for women in the religion as there are for men either. I mean, very limited.
Could you expound that, Clay? And maybe you can also comment as well, too.
Basically, women aren't allowed in teaching positions. They're not allowed to speak from the pulpit. And, you know, basically it's get married or be single and, you know, be a pioneer. I think they can do that. But as far as choices, I know all the ones I've talked to just felt like it was very limited. Like there wasn't very much they could do. Like what she's saying, you can be of service to everyone and that's about it.
I'm sorry. What was that again?
Like picking up the pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what would you say is, to just continue with your story? So you're talking about like being a young child and stuff like that. What was it like maybe like in your adolescent years, being in your teens? Cause it's pretty much you grew up your whole life, grew up like that. What was it like continuously like growing up?
Yeah. So I was always kind of a free spirit rebel. Like my brother was the perfect, example of like a Jehovah's Witness child, but I was always pushing the boundaries. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, I rebelled. I remember in fifth grade, I was just cursing up a storm in school, and I, you know, I just was trying to figure it out. So yeah, I wanted to be friends with everyone, but I also had to uphold being a Jehovah's Witness. Mm. So it was kind of tricky. And there was only ever like my brother, myself, and maybe like one or two other Jehovah's Witnesses in the school all growing up. So yeah, it was just kind of odd. So growing up and going to public schooling, I was just trying to be friends with everyone and trying to do it all. It was really hard for me. I always kind of loved the idea of Christmas. Like I just love the Christmas commercials and I just wanted to be part of it. And in school, starting out in elementary school, there'd be the concerts, you know, the Christmas concerts. Yeah. And I would have to stay in the classroom by myself, doodling on the chalkboard while everyone was down there doing their Christmas thing. And it felt like an eternity. And I was just trying to pretend like, this is cool. I'll pretend to be a teacher. I've got this time to myself. But I was miserable. I was like, I am missing out. And everyone knows that I'm up here. And then, you know, they come walking in and you're here by yourself. It just kind of feels isolating. Mm. Yeah. And definitely. So my heart was never fully in it, but
there's not any alternative. I mean, like, what's
you
the
don't
alternative?
Have a
this
choice.
Is,
yeah.
This is your life. And so it's like, this is not normal, but it is normal because you don't really have anything else to really measure it by. What would you say? I mean, given all the theology of the Watchtower, we fleshed that out a little bit. I mean, what would you say growing up, what was your idea of like God or Jehovah and life like in the Watchtower and just like going, what they taught you about, you know, the gospel and like their version of the New World Translation? What was it like for you in like hearing that? Like, what was your thought process dealing with everything that they were teaching?
I was always so confused. I just couldn't grasp it. I couldn't understand what Jesus and Jehovah's role was. I couldn't understand. I mean, even to this day, honestly, I don't understand a lot of it. And I can't really put myself there too much. Maybe PTSD a little bit. I just can't really think about their beliefs a whole lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just could never put my mind around it.
Hmm. Would you, so what would you say you got, to, what would you say like a point where, what was like your first big kind of like, we talked about this before, kind of like the cognitive dissonance moment where you are, it's your, this is your family's life and they are, and this is your life because you're part of the family. Like what were some big moments you would say that were kind of like, that cognitive dissonance, okay, this is not adding up. I'm not sure if I quite believe this. Were there any particular moments or events that lead up to that?
Well, I mean, it was just a lot of going through the motions and just what it was for me, at least. I know for some people it's different because their heart was sincerely in it and they believed what was being taught to them. But for me, I just went along with it. You know, I was just trying to make everyone else happy. And I mean, yeah, you don't have a choice. So like, unless you're throwing up or you're really sick, you yeah. are there.
Yeah.
I remember one time I had so much homework. I was doing homework in the car. And then I had a part at that meeting on a Thursday night. And I went up onto the stage with my backpack and it was loaded with my books because I was just trying to find time to do my homework.
Mm.
And then, yeah, I mean, so hard to wrap my mind around all of it and focus on saying just a little bit of stuff, but it was just never an option to leave. And so I was trying to make everyone happy. And honestly, I was just never enough. I was never enough for my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I was never enough for the people in the Kingdom Hall. If I was sick or I didn't show up for a big reason, obviously, it was always like, where were you?
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't you here? And then also my relationship with Jehovah. I remember going to what they call return visit. So someone who goes, yeah, thanks for coming to my door, please come back. And as a Jehovah's Witness, you see it as a return visit. It becomes a Bible study and so on. And there was a single mom with her teenage daughter. And man, we grew to love them. They were just incredible. But I remember every time we went, the mom would see the front of the magazine and go, you're my guardian angel, which obviously we didn't believe in. But she was just like, wow, this is an answer to my prayer. And every time that magazine just so happened to be what she needed.
Mm.
And I thought, what? Like, good for her, but my prayers haven't been answered. These magazines don't hit my heart at all. Like, to me, it was always kind of like when you see your horoscope in the newspaper, you check it out. I mean, back in the day, I would check it out and be like, well, yeah, I can relate. It's so generalized that like everyone can relate to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
But it, yeah, I mean, it, yeah.
And you're talking about the Awake magazines too, right?
The Awake and the Watchtower.
Yeah,
so
usually.
The Watchtower was always a bit deeper of a topic. So the Awake was always what I could kind of relate to more. And when I would go door to door, I would always kind of lead with the Awake. I always had a lot of Watchtowers left because if I had to leave something at the door because no one showed up, I was like, I'm leaving the Awake because the Watchtower is just a little bit too, like, terrifying.
Subjects. Well, yeah, it's funny because I just watched, I posted this on our Instagram. I watched a movie. I don't know if you've heard of or seen it. It was called Apostasy. And it was about, I think it was a British film. And it was just accounting. It was stunning. It felt, and again, I'm the outsider here. But all the comments on the YouTube video for the trailer, they just said this is so accurate in regards to like to what it was like. Being, you know, a joke growing up on the Watchtower, a lot of people who experience, you know, the disfellowshipping and the disconnection or just even like the emptiness and the pressure of what it's like. And I was telling you like how in the movie, like inside the Kingdom Hall, like they're all sitting down there in the movie, it was all quiet. There's no music. And they're like scrunching you can hear like the paper of like whatever they're holding, like kind of like scrunching back and forth. Like and everyone's like sitting, like kind of not looking side to side.
I think they catch how painful the meetings can be at times.
Yeah.
If it's even possible, really.
So like,
you'd hate to have a cold and have a cough. Sitting in the front, and have to use the bathroom, not during a song.
Yeah, when we sing songs, they hit a cassette and play the music, and we sing to this canned music.
Yeah. I remember you talking about that.
So funny.
But there's this particular scene at the very beginning, Jackie, where the two girls in the film, they're sisters, and they've got their booth out there, and I'm assured you experienced this. There's the going the door to door, but then there's just standing at a particular place, maybe in a busy part of town. And so you said when you grew up, you said you're in Pennsylvania, or is
yeah,
New York?
I was, yeah.
Okay. So you have those times where you're like at those little booths with all the different pamphlets and such.
Those are new. Like, those are really new.
Yeah, that wasn't a part of it when I was there. I just went to the doors.
Okay. Yeah. So there's just a scene where they're there and they're like by this booth and like no one's really coming up to them. And they're all of a sudden they feel like there's this pressure, like no one's talking to us. Like we're going back like empty handed and they're almost like dreading it, you know, because you're going out there to try and perform. And that's probably similar too, because a lot of times, you know, I've talked to people, they have to like go door to door and you almost have reports you have to do and quotas and stuff like that. But yeah, there always just seems to be this, I've seen like people in the Watchtower, like this constant pressure to perform, like in every aspect of it. Cause like as Christians, it's not an aspect where you want to share Jesus with someone. It's not because like no one's forcing you to do it. Well, you have to force yourself to do it, because sometimes you have like your self-preservation where you don't want to like you want to be comfortable and not be uncomfortable. But God says you need to die to yourself and share the truth with people. But it's something that comes like naturally as a Christian, like an inclination. You don't have like a quota you have to do.
I think it's pretty common for witnesses to feel like they're never good enough, no matter what you do. No matter how many hours you put in, there's always going to be that criticism of needing to do more. Are you sure that's enough? Are you sure you're not? You could do more.
Yeah. So how many? Yeah. So how many brothers and sisters did you have, or do you have? Growing up.
What's that? Sorry.
No, we're all connections. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have two brothers and a sister.
Okay. And what was your relationship like with them? You can talk a little about your parents and like your classmates and stuff like that. What was it like with them growing up?
Yeah. So my oldest brother and sister were actually half siblings. And so growing up with them was a little bit like hit or miss due to, they'd be at their mom's sometimes and at our house sometimes. And then I had my brother that was my full brother. And so we grew up more side by side.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, I have nothing but love for my family and zero bitterness at all.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, growing up, you know, he was just such a great kid. He's still a great guy. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But he just did it all right as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
You know, got the good grades. He would be the kid that would raise his own money and go buy his own school clothes. He would have the parts at the meeting and walk the mics to people. And yeah, I mean, in a way I looked up to him, and at the same time I was constantly reminded that like I just could never even be that level, you know.
I got to run mics, but then it just gets taken away when you do something wrong. So
because
you know, you get disciplined when you don't follow the rules. And so, you know, you would get privileges in the hall, but then you would do something wrong and they would take it away and publicly like say that you had done something wrong, you know, in front of the whole congregation.
Yeah.
So to me, it was like getting those privileges was just a way for them to kind of hold it over me and use it against me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was always jealous. I always wished I could do the mic thing.
Yeah. The mics were fun. It was a good distraction from the boringness.
Yeah. As a lady, I just had to sit there the whole time.
You guys weren't allowed.
Yeah.
No. Just sit there and look pretty.
Yeah. Yep.
So you're in this position to where you're wanting everyone's approval and acceptance, both with your parents, with your brothers and sisters, you know, wanting to maintain those relationships. You're wanting to make the elders happy and do everything with these meetings. But now it's like you're trying to impress your teachers, because then you got this backpack full of all your supplies and everything. So this is... when you're talking about that, was that like junior high or is that high school for you? Like
all throughout, but yeah, junior high and all that was just getting harder with, you know, schooling, just being more demanding and wanting to be friends with everyone and just trying to balance it all.
Mm. Would you say, it sounds like it's leading up, it probably like led up to a point, because you can only go for so long where, you know, as the saying goes, something has to give, you know, mm-hmm. with especially being as performance-based as you are. And there's been times too where, like, I think one, just biblically speaking, like one of my favorite stories in the Gospels is a story when between, I believe, Mary and Martha were there. One is working very hard and trying to do everything for this event, and she's trying to make everything perfect, you know, doing all this performance. But then you have the other one sitting at the feet of Jesus. And obviously you see like the difference between the two. One is like working hard versus, you know, and there's a contrast there too. But what would you say was it that eventually like there was like a giving point that kind of pushed things forward with, along with your story?
Yeah, it was kind of frustrating because one of the very few of the Jehovah's Witnesses that went to school with me, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I don't know if Clay can relate. I'm sure he can. But for me, like, my family was like the prime example of a Jehovah's Witness family. Mm-hmm. And then there was a girl that I grew up being best friends with, and her mom was a single parent. And I don't know, I guess less, not because she was a single parent. I don't know exactly what it was, but the spotlight wasn't on them as much.
Yep.
So my friend was able to be part of track and be part of all these teams and be friends with everyone. And like, there was zero consequence.
Yeah.
Like, it was just kind of like, oh, we expect that, whatever. But from you, you know, so I just got sick of living for everyone else and it never even being enough. So I'm like, okay, I'll do what it takes. I don't have a say in it. So I'm just going to do my best and try and figure it out and just be this like bland person, just trying to do it all, but then never measuring up. I just got tired, you know? And even if, I mean, like I said, my parents are incredible, but I just was never enough. So if I would have been enough for my parents or enough for somebody, maybe I would have been a little less exhausted, but I just couldn't measure up. And I just got tired and I wanted to live and figure out who I was. So yeah, I just was done.
Yeah. That's the works-based mentality. I think it runs anybody into the ground.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, filling out that field service report. And
yep. Quotas.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah. So you're at a point, you're tired and you're just going and going and going. And where does it go from there?
So my oldest brother had been disassociated. So disfellowshipping is when the elders make that choice for you that you're done and you're no longer part of the organization. But disassociating is when you make that decision to no longer be recognized. So the punishment is like essentially the same, but you're making the choice. So he disassociated himself around the age of like 19. And so I always used him as an excuse to not get baptized. I was like, well, it's so serious. And I want to make sure I'm doing it for the right reasons. And I just, you know, I want to make sure I'm doing my best. And so that bought me a little bit of time. And so then in high school, like senior year, I had been secretly dating a guy for 2 years that was not a Jehovah's Witness.
No.
Scandalous.
<Yeah.
laughs> I mean, my parents knew something was up, but they didn't know what. So
yeah,
at the age of 19, I just was done. And I remember pulling into the driveway. I was in the car with my mom. And we pull up and I just started bawling. And I was like, I cannot do this anymore. And she wasn't even surprised. You know, I think mother intuition too, you know, I get it now.
Yeah.
She knew something was going on. I think you can tell when someone's heart isn't in something. But yeah, it was harder for me. I think in that moment, I just felt partially relieved and also like that crushing part of like, I just failed her 100%.
And the decision to leave the religion, and when you lose the association with, you know, all your friends and family, it doesn't really taken effect immediately. It's something that happens over time, mm-hmm. where it sinks in, and you know, the decision that you make, it really affected me over time. Because, you know, when it happens, it's just kind of a whirlwind, and it feels like such, like she was saying, relief, you know. But then, you know, as time, I don't know if that's the way it affected you, but as time went by, you know, family and friends not being there for you, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's an aspect, too, where, like, something like that happens, and all of a sudden, like, you know, first of all, it kind of reminds you, you're talking about, like, going to the driveway and having this, like, emotional breakdown. There's a, I don't want to give too much away, but if you guys... the movie Apostasy, you definitely need to watch it.
Oh, I saw it, yeah.
Okay, so you know the scene I'm talking about. I want to be as spoiler-free as possible.
I haven't watched it yet.
But the one scene you know I'm talking about, Jackie, where the older girl who's, she gets, basically she's trying to be reinstated, and mm-hmm. she's just like, I can't do it anymore, and she's outside, mm-hmm. and of course, I mean, it's a UK movie, so I was confused. I'm like, why is she in the driver? Why is she in the passenger seat of her car? Oh, yeah. It's a British movie. But there's this
minor detail.
Yeah, but there's a moment that stuck out for me that when she gets emotional, she just looks at her mom and she's like, do you know what it's like? Do you have any idea what it's like to spend your whole life trying to please Jehovah and to never be good enough no matter how hard I try?
Yeah.
And having that, I was like, wow, that was like eye opening for me. And it was like, oh, I wanted to just like jump through the screen and be like, you know what? Yeah. You can, you know, you actually can. You've been like this. That wasn't God to begin with.
Yeah.
There's hope here.
That's what's sad about it is it makes people really give up on God. That's what makes me mm-hmm. sad about it. And, you know, that's exactly what I did. So many other witnesses just like, you know what? This God is a jerk and I can never live up to his. What he wants from me. So mm-hmm. just forget it. And that was, you know, that was the choice. I wish I could have found, Jesus and the Lord sooner, but I had to go through that. And every witness is different. You know, every person is different, but
yeah.
Yeah. So you're at the point. So you got to a point where you said, you told your mom that you're done. You can't do it anymore. And that had to be hard because, you know, you've always wanted your mom's like acceptance and approval and always wanting to do everything, but you kind of knew that something had to give. So essentially, like, you had to give up really a core part of your identity, not just your mom's approval, because that was like wrapped up in it, but then like your identity as someone who is, you know, a Jehovah's Witness and part of Jehovah's kingdom, and knowing probably what you were taught about and indoctrinated about of what life is like outside if you leave Jehovah's kingdom, that there's no hope for you. I mean, I'm sure there's probably a lot you're trying to go through and process during that time. You would say that though, correct?
Absolutely. So I would just like to make it known too. I was an unbaptized publisher. Mm. So it's like the step before you get baptized. So I was never baptized into the faith. So technically the punishment is different. Like, so it's all like conscience based. So like, oh, my conscience can't handle it, or it can. Like, there's a lot put on that. Leaving that. So I wrote a letter into the elders, and if I can remember correctly, I had met up with them. Yes, I had met up with them, had my letter, and I was just like so naive. I was just like, because I had grown up in it. I was in it for 19 years. People mm-hmm. knew me from the moment I was born. You know, and I felt like they were invested in me personally. Mm. And so I was just like, my friends are never going to leave my side. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll still be there. And no, you lose everything. And I think the feeling of like being refreshed because you're out of it is kind of minimal at that point. Mm. I just was like, okay, I was still living under my parents' roof. And for some reason, they allowed me to stay there. And because I wasn't baptized, I wasn't like ignored as if I was disfellowshipped. And so I'm grateful for that. I've known a lot of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that have been in that position where they were living in the same home and like essentially ignored. And that breaks my heart. Mm. I think it's hard no matter what. But I lost everyone. And my relationship with my parents and my family was definitely... it took a hit. They didn't fully push me out, but yeah, it was known that it was never going to be the same.
It's a lot less harsh when you don't get baptized because you're still convertible when you're not baptized yet.
Yeah.
Once you've been baptized and rejected it, mm-hmm. so you've accepted it and then rejected it, there's no saving you. You're apostate at that point.
But. Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking too, Jackie, mm-hmm. your brother, he chose to leave. So again, it's different than like, you know, being forced out. But if you don't mind me asking, what was his reasoning behind why he left?
I honestly don't know for sure.
Okay.
He's kind of private about things. And so I've mm-hmm. just always respected that.
Yeah.
He doesn't really like to talk about it much. Mm,
okay.
But when you disassociate, though, it's a little bit more like conscience based. So like people can kind of make the choice, but it's still pretty harsh of a punishment. Like, for example, when my grandpa passed away about 10 years ago, I think exactly, I was no longer a Jehovah's Witness at that point. I was 22. We went to the Kingdom Hall for the service. And so we're like lined up as family, and my brother's at the end of it. So it was kind of weird because like, as you walk in, he's the first guy.
Yeah.
And it just broke my heart because people would just pass him up. And it was his grandpa that passed. Like some people would say hi, some wouldn't. And I just want to share a point too, since I'm on that topic of that time. Mm-hmm. I had left and I was newly saved as a Christian. And I know I'm kind of bypassing some stuff that we'll get back to, but
yeah,
I'm in that line. And this older lady that knew me my whole life, she comes over to me and she hugs me like not a loving hug. She like held me close to the point like I couldn't like get away at all. And she said, "You need to come back. You're running out of time." And I was like, "Also, you need to let go of me." Like I was so stern, and I had my new boyfriend next to me who was a worship leader. And he was just like, "I knew something was going down because you were like, you let her know what was going on." It was just like so not fair that here I am mourning the loss of my grandfather who we lived with him. Mm. You know, he was like another parent to me. And she's taking this opportunity to tell me that I'm running out of time.
Yep.
And so I just was like, no, this is not the time to talk to me about this. And it was just sad because there was like zero love involved in that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times what you'll see a lot of times in the cultish infrastructure is everything's so mechanical and monotonous, and that you have to do these things. It's so performance based and so mechanical. I think one of the things it does, it really strips people of compassion. Like you forget what it is like to even like feel or have emotions. In fact, I was talking with someone earlier today who's a fifth generation Christian scientist, and they have the same thing where they believe that they're against all any sort of medical practice or getting any sort of like doctor treatment. And that includes like in the fields of like mental health as well too. Whether it's like you need to go to psychologists or a therapist, but you know, that's one of those things too, where you have, I mean, we talk about this too, like everyone has their stuff and their issues they got talked through, but you have an environment in which you're growing up in, and there's no place to like really talk about it. Yeah. I think like the behaviors like that, it's like, what do you expect in an environment like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can't talk about it. If you have any doubt or you're going through something or struggling with anything, you're prepared that if you talk to anyone, they will tell you, "Sorry, but if you don't go to your parents and the elders, I'm going to have to do it for you." Mm. So you don't get comfort. You don't get the help that you need. You're instantly like blackmailed.
Yeah. There's really like no one to talk to. That's,
yeah.
And that's why if you listen to our episode with Clay, you're like, that's why you became like the perfect AA guy, because all of a sudden you could talk and like you were really good at going to meetings.
Yeah. I already had that one down.
Yeah. So you're at a point like where, you know, you're at this point. What would you say, like right when you got out, talk just a little bit too about like what life is like on the outside. I mean, obviously there's that moment of, okay, I have this confrontation with my parents. Now I'm like life outside. I mean, just talk about that. I mean, there's a transition time before you knew about the true Jesus. Like, yeah. Talk about that. I mean, it sounds like there's an interesting gap between that.
Yeah. So I was 19 when I left. I didn't want anything to do with God because the God that I knew just failed me. He was like a wuss. You know, he just gave the world to Satan and was like, here, give it back to me when you're done. Like, he didn't even have control over the world. And I was never enough for him. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I never knew who he was. And so leaving it, I still believed in Jehovah or some form of God. But I was not even close to interested in knowing who that was. So I just carried on trying to live with my parents and just survive. It's kind of a blur at that point from 19 to 21. It's kind of a blur for me, honestly.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, was still allowed to live at home. And I think because in their eyes, I was neutral. Like, I always, even though I left, I still respected what they did. And I wasn't like an apostate. I didn't speak out about it. I just kept working and doing my thing. But so at 21, sorry, I'm skipping stuff. I just honestly can't really remember a lot.
That's fine.
It's been a lot of years now, but
it's all good.
What's that?
No, go ahead. I'm just listening.
So when I was 21, so I had a curfew, even at 19, I still had a curfew and I was just not good with it. I didn't understand why I still had to follow the house rules when I was an adult. So I pushed that a little bit. And so at 21, I was terrible. This one night, I just stayed out all night and I didn't answer the phone. And now as a parent, I'm like, wow.
Okay.
I get it now. I'm like, that was horrible. And I do regret doing that. But so then I stayed out that night, got home in the morning, and it wasn't good. And then I think it was like that night or the next day, whenever I did something wrong to the point that it needed to be addressed, I would have a note typed up, slipped under my door from my mom. It was never this face-to-face conversation. It was just always this typed up letter, very dramatic. So I had that. I had a note saying, you need to be out by this date, you know, and made it seem like I did it all the time, which honestly I didn't. That I think they were kind of looking for a reason to get me out of the house. Yep. And I can't blame them. I'm thankful that they kept me under the roof as long as they did. So I got kicked out and I moved to a city in Pennsylvania, but it was bigger. And I started going to school a little bit and working and had my own apartment. And they were still in my life. It was kind of weird. I think my parents, not to speak for them, I think they kind of struggled with following the guidelines but still wanting to be parents. I remember they took me, I don't know if you have this out there, but they took me to Sam's Club. They took me there and like got me some things I needed for my apartment after they kicked me out. And I was just like,
it's tough on parents. I mean, they have to do the unthinkable. And it takes. I know there's some parents that because I was in the religion for 32 years. So some of my friends got disfellowshipped and their parents still talk to them and would hang out with them. My parents would never do that, you know, but there's just different degrees that like their conscience would allow. But I imagine it's so hard to just give your kid up and just say, bye, you're done.
I mean, maybe some of it too has to do with like the type of where the culture that they're in, as far as like how they deal with like honor and dishonor and stuff like that, whether or not they're going to continue to have a relationship with their kids. Jackie, with your parents, and maybe this is I'm just curious about this as well too. I mean, from their perspective, I mean, I can just imagine they're probably, I'm not sure what the exact translation of the Watchtower is of this proverb where it says, you know, train up a child in the way which they should go, or maybe it's like the way in which Jehovah would go, you know? So like they're taught as a parent, you need to train up your kids to be the perfect Jehovah's Witness. And they spent all this time with you and even like your older brother. And now they have two kids that they arguably, I would just say, assume the best, and they did their best of what they thought was right to make you the best Jehovah's Witness possible now that you have two that leave. Is there an aspect of like parents who are in the, are going to the Kingdom Hall and like they know they have two kids who have left, like there's something wrong with them that they did? I mean, what's, what would that be like?
Yeah, I'm sure that they felt like they failed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a lot of time to put into your child and hope. Like, as a Christian now, I would be really sad if my kids chose a different way. But, like, yeah. I would just never be able to separate from them mm-hmm. for any reason. So I'm sure they felt like they failed a bit. But I think my parents are very different, how they handle things and how, just in general, they're very different. And so I think for my mom, she kind of thrived on it. You know, the attention that she got from me not being part of it anymore. When my brother left, that was her stepson. So I don't, that dynamic was a little bit different too. She wasn't really the one fully raising him up into it, you know?
Okay.
So, but yeah, I'm sure it was really hard for my parents to feel like, I mean, not only did I go a different way, but they think like, if you leave Jehovah's organization, you leave Jehovah. Like, yeah. you are done with God as a whole. And there's no good conclusion. Like, you're just done. Mm. And, like, you won't be on paradise earth. Like, there's zero hope. So I think it would really, if you're fully believing what you're being taught as a Jehovah's Witness, like, as a parent, I can't even imagine the heartache when your child leaves.
I could definitely relate. I mean, at least understand what you're talking about just in regards to you know, just having the difficulties and complexities of the different family relationships. So eventually, you said, so it got to a point where your mom gave you this deadline, right? And again, you said, I want to understand, like, really, like, the human side of it. Like, there are people that still love you, and they probably thought they were doing the best thing for you, because ultimately, you would think that they'd want, they're true believers in what they're doing, so they'd want to do whatever they can to get you back into Jehovah's kingdom. So that's, I would assume maybe they're trying to do the best thing for you by telling you you need to, like, leave our household and experience what life is like on the outside to make you want to come back in. So once you got the once this letter happened, and I'm assuming you moved out, where did it go from there?
Yeah, so I moved to a bigger city and started going to school out there and working and had my own apartment. And it was the emptiest time in my life. The friends that I had in that school, they were there for me as long as I was down to drink. As long as I was ready for a good time, they were there. But the second that I needed them, or the second that I thought about leaving school, you know, it was just more conditional love. Like, I knew it well, but I really needed them. Like, I had lost all of the friends that I had known. And so, like, I just really needed that friendship, and they just weren't there. So I remember I went to, when I was living out there, I was about 21. I went to do laundry at a laundromat, and there were magazines from the Jehovah's Witnesses on the table. And I knew that happened because I used to drop magazines off at laundromats also. But this one had an air bubble around it, the mouth, and it said, "I'm in a cult." And I was, like, mad. I've always been a bit protective of Jehovah's Witnesses because that's my entire family.
Even on the outside now.
On the outside, I was protective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. I still was like, I don't agree with the beliefs, but, like, as people, like, let's not attack them, you know?
Right.
So I just remember being impacted a lot by that. I was feeling so lonely and I did not really care what happened to me. I just had the emptiest life, had nothing to do with God. And I just was like, whatever happens, happens. Mm. And so at that point, I just needed something. I needed to feel some sort of love or compassion. And so I called my mom up and was like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to go to school anymore. Like, I'll come back to meetings. Like, it's fine.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. So my poor parents, you know, they did what they could to help me to get the right wardrobe and all the stuff to look the part. And I went to a meeting out in that area. I remember my brother that was still in the religion came out with his wife and took me to the meeting and took me out to lunch. Like, it was a celebration. Like, yeah,
they thought you were coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, pull out the red carpet, you know, the gal's back. But so then I moved back home and I went to the meetings for, I would say, a month at the most. And I mean, within that first week or two, the spark is off. And people are like, okay, she's back.
Big deal.
Yeah, big deal. She's here. And so I was like, I mean, I knew going into it, it was not the best idea, but I was just grasping at straws, you know? So I was like, nope, I did it for the wrong reason. And so I just stopped going back to meetings and my parents allowed me to stay living with them. Mm. I started working at a coffee shop and man, it was an awesome job. And I was working with a lot of people that were amazing. I was working with these women, a few women that were Christians. And before I even knew they were Christians, I was like, something's different about them. Like, they've got something different. Like, I could just see it in them. And I was gravitating. I can't even say it right. I was just really drawn to them. Mm. And I found out what church they went to, and I just knew when I'm ready, which is not yet, but when I'm ready, I'm going to start going to their church because, like, they've got something real.
Mm. Like, yeah. Real, like, a real, authentic, genuine joy that mm-hmm. comes from within, not because they're not following a quota. They're not saying, hey, you need to show yourself as being a really joyous person to, like, 15 people a week at the coffee shop you work at. You just make the best of, like, being where you are, where God's placed you, and just look for those opportunities to share with people. So I am very excited. It seems like this is going to take a very interesting and very exciting turn. So we're roughly at the 50-minute mark. So what we're going to do is, this has been a great first part of Leaving the Jehovah's Witnesses Volume 3 with Jackie, and I'm really excited. Jackie Primo. And this has been a great discussion so far. We're going to go ahead and wrap things up here in part one. Again, if you guys also just want to check out the previous volumes of Leading the Jehovah's Witnesses, Clay, thanks to you for coming on here. And we'll obviously check out volume one and two. Clay's in volume one. So we are going to just kind of jump into part two just a little bit. And we'll talk more with Jackie Primo about her continued journey in the Jehovah's Witnesses, now the Jehovah's Witnesses, and what happened from there. So we'll talk to you guys next time on Cultist. Talk to you soon.